Welcome back to the Nature Stories Podcast. I'm Samantha Brown. This week, more stories from the heart of the land, a new public radio series which considers a connection between people and the natural world. The Nature Stories Podcast is curated by Atlantic Public Media in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. Hear stories from the heart of the land host, Jay Allison.
At 22,000 feet above sea level, Mount Kailash is far from the highest mountain in western Tibet, but it still beckoned to Scott Carrier, who produced our next story. Mount Kailash is a sacred site for many different religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism, and yet it's so remote that only a few thousand pilgrims visit each year. People don't climb this mountain, they circle it. And Scott wanted to join them. What drew him was the idea, as he said, that you can become something just by imagining it. He also told us as he was leaving, "I think I have everything, except I can't find the case for my sunglasses. I'll have to wear them all the time."
At 15,000 feet above sea level, Lake Mansarovar in western Tibet is the highest freshwater lake in the world. In mid-afternoon, it's exceedingly bright, and there are no trees. So the only way to escape the sun is by closing your eyes. And even then, you can still see. The name Mansarovar means consciousness lake, as Hindus believe it to be a manifestation of the mind of Brahma, the creator of the universe. The water is dark blue, black in places where wind is skimming over the surface. The sky is also dark blue, nearly black. Hindus also believe that anyone who goes swimming in this lake will have all his sins or her sins erased. But I tried it already, and I don't think it worked. This morning I got up early, went for a walk, and saw some nomads who'd spent the night beside the lake. They were an extended family with grandparents and babies, pilgrims from some other part of Tibet, come to walk around the sacred mountain, Mount Kailash, just 10 miles to the north. The sun had come up but was buried behind heavy clouds, and there were 3 inches of new snow on the hills above the lake. It was cold, and I was watching the nomads take down their canvas tents. They pulled the stakes, took out the center and corner poles, and tossed the canvas in the back of the Chinese cargo truck they were all traveling in. And then there was nothing left to pick up or put away. They had no stuff, no gear. They'd slept in their long coats or chupas on the bare ground, and their chupas were filthy with dirt and grease, as were their hands and faces. They looked like homeless people, but they've lived here for thousands of years. My friend Lisa has a video camera, and she's taping these kids with the screen turned around so they can see themselves. We're in Darchen, the village at the southern base of Mount Kailash, where you start walking the kora, or circuit, around the mountain. The houses are made of adobe bricks that are the same color as the road. They have low, flat roofs made from wooden beams imported from Nepal. Inside, they lay sheets of linoleum over compressed dirt floors and cook on sheet metal stoves that burn chunks of dried yak dung. Motorcycles going by are all Chinese four-strokes with roll bars and wind fairings and mud flaps, fake snow leopard skin seats decorated with flying tassels and painted with eternal knots, swastikas, lotus blossoms, and flames. The riders are young men with yak bone berets in their hair, wearing leopard skin cowboy hats, red vests, turquoise necklaces. They look like mock gauchos, but they're yak herders, yak boys, come to town on their ponies. In the middle of town, there's a row of shops where you can buy last-minute items for the hike. barley flour or sampa, Snickers bars, beer, cigarettes, pots and pans. In front of the shops, out in the open air, there are a couple of pool tables, one with a four-year-old girl up on top, dancing and dropping balls while her friends shoot around her. We begin the Kora, the pilgrim's path, clockwise around the mountain, falling in on the trail with some nomads, 25 yaks, and a few horses. Some of the yaks wear prayer flags and have ribbons braided into their hair. Others carry loads. One girl has a white lambskin hat shaped like a tall coffee cup and a white coat with bells on the fringes. This man has an amulet around his neck and a long knife around his waist. I ask him a question through our guide, and he looks at me like I'm a talking shoe.
Where are you going with your yaks today?
He says they're from down by the lake, and they're walking around the mountain, practicing their religion just like they always do and always have done. Then he stoops down and picks up a dried yak dung off the trail and puts it inside his coat, or chupa. You couldn't live here without yak dung. You'd freeze and starve to death. I can see the trail going up the canyon maybe 2 miles ahead of me, and also 2 miles looking back from where we came. The canyon is a half pipe, a mile wide and a half mile high. The people spread out along the trail look like little beetles, maybe 80 to 100 in all. I guess that half are foreigners from Europe, Japan, India. The other half are Tibetan nomads.
So, where are you from?
Kanelenza.
This man, Seyon Dorji, is a nomad from Nabri, 400 miles to the east. He says he came here in the back of a cargo truck with his wife and children and grandchildren, 11 in all.
Why did you want to come here? Why did you want to come to Mount Kailash?
They came to purify negative karma by praying for all sentient beings under the six realms of existence.
And how's it going? How is your trip going so far?
He says, basically, I'm 61 years old and it's pretty hard. Maybe because I have bad karma from killing so many animals in my lifetime.
Do you think that your life will be different after you complete this trip? You think you will change?
No, he says, this is not for this lifetime. This lifetime, I'm a poor nomad. But if I purify my karma, then maybe in the next lifetime, I won't have to be mean to animals. This is not for now, but when I die, it will help. Most of the foreigners walking around the mountain have hired porters to carry their backpacks. At $10 a day, it's a good deal, considering the elevation and the distance.
You see these prayer flags here? This is a.
But this man, Paul Garden from Norfolk in England, is carrying his own load, which only amounts to some food and a sweater stuffed inside a Tibetan chupa. This is his eighth time around the mountain.
But the tradition is to do it 13 times. So this is the goal. It's taking me 2 days each trip to get around. Once I did it in one day, but I think once was enough. Yes, there was a bit of a Forrest Gump day. I just couldn't stop. I was full of adrenaline or something. It's like I can walk for hours on end and I'm only really present to the silence here. You must have noticed the profound silence in this place. It's like walking through a dream. here. I've studied yoga in India for years. Huh. I'm kind of drawn that way anyway.
Huh. So is this like yoga, is walking around during the course?
Yes, exactly.
How is it like yoga?
Well, yoga is the union of the mind and body in order to experience the soul. That's the true definition of the word, union. You know, you find a rhythm with the walking and the breathing and the you're sort of aware of the silence, and initially you feel the energy raise from the bottom coming up, and for me it's settled in my the between the solar plexus and my heart chakra as I'm walking. Yes.
And is that good? Is that where you want it?
It's not a case really of what I want. You just be aware of what happens, and but I'm very happy with what's going on. Yes. Over the moon, as we say in England. Yes.
This sound could be a yak dung fire inside a stove, or rain falling on a roof, but it's the wind ripping through 1,000 prayer flags on the north side of the mountain. I look up and see the full-on north face and the summit, less than 2 miles away, a mile above my head. Only two people are said to have been on top, Buddha and the Buddhist saint Milarepa, but they didn't climb up. Buddha flew as a black-necked crane, and Milarepa rode on the first rays of the morning sun. This is supposed to be the most powerful spot on the circuit around the mountain. It's said that from here, the gods and spirits are so close they can hear your prayers, and as you make a wish, they'll do everything they can to make it come true. I wish for more oxygen. At 17,000 feet, my cells are getting only half what they get at sea level, and they don't like it. Everything's supposed to be coming together at this point, but I have a headache between my eyes. At night, we sleep, or try to sleep, in a two-man tent below the mountain. I somehow lost our water filter, so we have less than a quart between the two of us, and I didn't eat very much for dinner, and my sleeping bag is basically a nylon sack with a little bit of down. Perfect for summer nights in the Utah desert, but it's not working at 17,000 feet. Every time I fall asleep, I dream I'm suffocating and wake up gasping for air. Then I have to struggle and concentrate on each and every breath, inhaling, exhaling, until I relax and go back to sleep, only to dream I'm suffocating and wake up gasping for air. So I get up and go for a walk. The tent is covered with frost. The air bites my teeth. I look up at the sky and am immediately attacked by infinity. The Milky Way is a thick white blanket that offers absolutely no warmth. The moon coming up over the mountains to the east is only a sliver, the thinnest excuse for a moon imaginable. The stars are needles in my eyes, and the mountain is luminescent and looming against the darkness. I walk over to the stream to get some water, but the water has frozen, like clear, hard muscle stretching over rocks. I feel like the mountain has its foot on my chest and is trying to kill me, which is somehow a relief. Once I realize this, I feel much better. I walk back to the tent, eat a Snickers bar, and go to sleep. In the morning, we begin the hardest part of the walk around the mountain, the trip up and over the Domala Pass at close to 19,000 feet above sea level. On the trail, there are four Tibetan pilgrims, three men and a woman, prostrating themselves around the mountain. They have aprons of carpet hanging over their chupas and Chinese house slippers on their hands. They stand with their hands or slippers clasped at the forehead, then at the throat, then at the heart, praying for refuge. Then they bend down and slide their slippers out in front of them along the ground until they're lying flat out, and they pray again. Then they get up, step one body length forward, and pray again. It will take them 6 or 7 days to go around the mountain this way, and they have no sleeping bags or water bottles, not even any food that I can see. People have been coming here, doing this, for thousands of years. The top of Domla Pass is shaped like a smooth saddle, but it feels like a bone, maybe a skull cap, or maybe it just feels like death. The pass is close to 19,000 feet above sea level, a rocky and barren foreign planet. And in the distance, there are mountains after mountains after mountains, and all the space in between. The more I look, the more I disappear. Cheyenne Dorje, the 61-year-old man I met yesterday, has made it to the pass with his extended family. He's climbing up on top of a big boulder that's like a symbolic horse. His grandson is helping him, and the women are offering advice and criticism. He gets up on top, throws a leg over the ridgeline like he's sitting in a saddle, and bends down to touch the rock with his lips. This stream comes from a glacier on the east side of the mountain. From here, the water runs down the canyon into Lake Mansarovar, then south across the Tibetan Plateau as the Sutlej River, down through the Himalayas, across the Punjab, emptying into the Arabian Sea. Then it will come back as clouds and fall as snow and freeze into ice that will eventually melt and run into this stream, a circle. 80 miles to the west, there are streams like this one that become the Indus River. 100 miles to the south, there are streams like this that flow into the Ganges. And 60 miles to the east are the headwaters of the Brahmaputra. These four rivers drain the Indian subcontinent. And in this way, this mountain is like a heart, and the rivers and clouds are like blood vessels, a circulatory system. Chinese scientists now say the glaciers in Tibet are melting at a rate of 50% every 10 years, which means that in 40 or 50 years, the circulatory system is going to disappear. From here, it's the long run out back to civilization. We'll follow the stream down the canyon, then get in our rented Land Cruiser and drive 4 days east across Tibet, then south through the Himalayas, back to Kathmandu. Back to traffic jams, dirty air, lots of problems and worry. The trick is going to be taking the mountain back with me, to not let it disappear, so I can stand there in the middle of the worry and feel the mountain like a foot on my chest.
Scott Carrier lives half a world away from Tibet, in Salt Lake City, close to his favorite mountains. He says, despite population pressure, he can still find patches of true wildness in the Utah mountains, but he won't tell us exactly where.
Scott's story comes from our series Stories from the Heart of the Land, produced by Atlantic Public Media. The Nature Stories podcast is produced with support from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting nature and preserving life. If you want to find out more on the podcast and the series, go to nature.org/stories. Bill Frisell composed and performed our music. Join me next week when we travel with an Aboriginal elder and a local teacher to the Northern Territory of Australia. From Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Samantha Brown.